Okay, welcome to CineLit. Today's episode, we are looking at two films in the rich career of David Lean. Lean is probably best known for his work doing lavish, meticulously staged films that ushered in the age of the Hollywood epic. Movies like Bridge on the River Kwai from 1957, Lawrence of Arabia from 1962, and his biggest box office hit, Dr. Zhivago from 1965. But we are casting our eyes back before the epics to post-war Britain and a brace of Charles Dickens adaptations that are among the most respected adaptations ever to have been put on film. We are looking at Great Expectations from 1947 and Oliver Twist from the year after 1948. So my name is Adam Marsh. I am the host of CineLit, and I am joined today by my co-host, Rebecca Taylor. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm good, thanks. Hi, everyone.
And as ever, we are joined by our resident CineLit expert, Daryl Buxton.
Hello, folks.
Cool. So, yeah, so David Lean, I guess we'll tackle this in chronological order, because there is a rhythm between those two Dickens adaptations that I think probably means you start with Great Expectations, even though it's one of Dickens' later books, as opposed to Oliver Twist. So, yeah, so Great Expectations. So this is regarded as one of the best Dickens adaptations. Not the best adaptation of Great Expectations, but the best Dickens adaptations, full stop. It's very well regarded. It was voted, I think, at number 7 or number 5 of the best British films of all time in 1999 when the BFI did their top 100 British films of all time. It was number 5. I think Oliver Twist clocked in the 40s. So, you know, both of these are relatively well respected, or at least were respected in 1999. The world has changed a lot since then, which I think we'll probably touch upon when we get to Oliver Twist in particular. But yeah, this one's like a number 5 Great Expectations. So it's very highly regarded. It was multiple Oscar nominated when it came out. Yeah, what do we think about it? Becky, what was your take on it? Because you're not a fan.
Of Great Expectations.
Of either, I think, yeah. Wasn't it?
I didn't like Oliver Twist at all, but we'll get onto that later. But yeah, Great Expectations. So I'd seen clips of it, like, when it's been on the TV and things, but I just generally found the adaptation quite dull, and I don't know if that's because I'm watching it as a modern viewer and I'm thinking of other adaptations and things, but it was just a bit too slow paced for me.
It's an interesting one, because it's the fourth adaptation of Great Expectations, but only the second sound adaptation. And the first sound adaptation was a very, very low-budget movie that I don't think many people saw. I think they're trying to be the definitive adaptation of Dickens. So they've been relatively faithful to the book. They are trying to nail it so that people who are aware of the book are watching the film and going, yep, that's exactly as I thought it was. Whereas I guess later adaptations have a bit more flexibility in messing around with characters, messing around with scenery, and messing around with the look of these things. Some of those early ones, I think, are trying to nail the definitive film version so that other people can mess around with it later on.
Yeah, having said that, I think there are sort of changes in both of these films that to quote Half Man, Half Biscuit, they irk the purists. Mm. But yeah, I think Dickens purists, although they might snipe at one or two little minor changes, I think even they would say exactly what you've just said, Adam. Yeah, these, if we've got to watch these on film at all, these are the go-to movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those sort of like Victorian authors are difficult to adapt into films because of the cadence of the way that the books are originally written for serialization mean that they don't translate well into a three-act structure movie. They have this weird cadence to them where every 10 minutes it reaches some sort of peak or crescendo turning point.
Yeah, that's a weird thing about adapting stuff from this era. And specifically about adapting Dickens,
it reminded me of bizarrely of Les Miserables, the film adaptation of that. And it occurs to me when I was watching that, it's like why I was so crushingly bored during that movie. and I suddenly realised that anybody who saw this on stage had a nice 20-minute break halfway through where they can go and knock back a couple of gins to get them through the rest of it and come back and enjoy it. and just realized, made me realise that those stereotypes are not designed to be movies. And in the same way as these serialised things, they're not designed to be, in the first place, they're not really designed to be novels. They're designed to be serialised stories. And they're certainly not designed to be a three-act structure film. So I think it does suffer from that piecemeal storytelling a little bit.
I rather like the way it plays. I think if you go in the knowledge that it's based on an episodic structure, you can sort of go with that. If you're sort of forewarned about that, I think it really works for the movie. And again, for modern viewers, if you're watching it on streaming or if you're watching it on Blu-ray or something, you know, it's nice to know that you will have a sort of natural break where you can sort of pause every half hour, you know, and watch it. Again, as a purist myself, I hate to say that about 1940s film. Normally, if you ask me that about Casablanca or something, I'd say no. You've got to sit with rapt attention from start to finish, you know, with Great Expectations. You sort of don't need to, you know, it's sort of very old fashioned and very modern. Now, given that I think there is a very evident sort of episodic structure to the movie adaptation, and since Becky, you were saying you're not a fan of this version, how did that play for you? Not just the sort of slowness of the film, but the fact that the story did seem to be sort of fragmented and characters were disappearing and then coming back later on, almost as though they're in episode one and episode five sort of thing. You know, did you find that a bit of a fault as well?
Yeah, actually, it's funny that you say that, Daryl, because I watched it with my mum and I said to my mum, is Miss Havisham coming back at all? And my mum was like, yeah, she comes back later in the story, because the way it was, it had that, obviously, that section as the young Pip, and then it jumps to the older Pip with John Mills, and then he goes off to the city to become a gentleman. And I was like, well, what's happening? What's happened to that story there? It just seemed to jump over. And then obviously,
that's always the case with these sort of stories. If you see that in a film today, you know, you sort of see kids in the opening scene or whatever, and then suddenly it's Tom Cruise, you know, and you're sort of thinking, well, who's he playing, you know? And you've jumped 20 years forward, and it does take you a few minutes to think, oh yeah, that's the kid we've just been watching grown up. You know, it takes a bit of skill, I think, for filmmakers to actually make those sort of transitions. And then, of course, the other problem that filmmakers still to this day have with this type of story that goes across the decades is when your characters then become older and they're played by the same actor, but they're having to put sort of makeup and things on, and in this case, sort of Dickensian whiskers and things like that. So, I mean, what one thing that occurred to me re-watching these films was... whenever you see a sort of parody of Dickens on TV, or if people talk about things being Dickensian, I don't think they are Dickensian, and I don't think they are parodying Dickens. I think what they're doing is they're looking at this template. They're parodying David Lean's idea of Charles Dickens.
I think I was saying this before we started recording the podcast. It's like whenever I think of Dickens, I think urchins, and I think there's a real lack of urchins in Great Expectations. I think that lens is the least Dickensian book of all of them.
They make up for that with Oliver.
Oh yeah, yeah, they go full on. Yeah.
And I think, you know, you get the youngster at the start of Great Expectations, so he's not what you'd call an urchin because he's too high class, but there's still the element of that about him that he's almost there as the sort of representation of that.
But I think when people think of Dickens, they think of poverty, and they think of rundown slums and things like that. That's the image. And this book doesn't do with that. They're all, I mean, they have the relatively working class characters, but they are sidelined, and it's all about him becoming a gentleman and having money and having more money and having and where's this money coming from? So it's like, it's not really about what Dickens tended to write about in a lot of his books.
And even the prisoner character Magwitch becomes a sort of well-to-do gent over the course of the story, you know, even though things don't end well for him. But again, I think when people look at Dickens and think, oh yeah, it's all about poverty, is there a tendency there for people to be thinking about David Lean's version of Oliver Twist and about the 60s musical Oliver and sort of basing it all on that? Because you know, other stories have been filmed as well, Tale of Two Cities and things like that. And I think there are only certain Dickens novels that sort of delve into that area. And Great Expectations, as you say, is one that sort of goes into a different sort of area. It's looking at different things and looking at different class structures and so on.
Yeah, but I think there are. Yeah, I haven't read all of Dickens' books, but yeah, I think he always had the two different classes together. Like you think about David Copperfield and Bleak House, and think they also show the upper classes as well. But yeah, I think maybe it's with Great Expectations, the balance is more so on the upper classes. You know, you've got Pip, who is working class, but then he becomes a gentleman. So, yeah.
And I think it owes more to kind of a Wuthering Heights kind of gothic melodrama than it does from what we traditionally think of as what Dickens did well. All that said, and I know this isn't David Lean specifically, but is there a better title than Great Expectations in cinema or novels? It's such a great title that allows you to interpret it in a numerous number of ways, you know what I mean?
It is, and even in the story itself and in Lean's movie itself, you know, it could mean all kinds of things at different times, and we do ultimately find out that there is a sort of specific meaning for it, but it could apply to any character, really.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, there are so many interesting characters in this. I think the Miss Havisham character at the core of it all is someone who almost sort of feels that she's failed in that respect and therefore wants to sort of project her wishes, her younger self's wishes, onto younger people as she sees them sort of growing up around her, you know. And there is this sense of her trying to live vicariously. She's almost, I mean, you mentioned the word gothic there, Adam, and that's something I really wanted to talk about in respect of both of these films, because she's almost a sort of vampiric type character in a good way, in a positive way, sort of feeding off the hopes and expectations of the young charges that she sort of takes into her home, you know.
And she can be killed by fire.
Yes, she can.
In the same way as vampires can.
She gets a great death scene. And in fact, there are connections with Hammer's Dracula movies, because there's a great long table in her dining room, which is very, very similar to the one that you see in Hammer's Dracula, which Peter Cushing sort of runs along. And there's even Peter Cushing in that scene when he destroys Christopher Lee's Dracula, leaps off that table and pulls down a huge pair of curtains, very thick curtains. And that happens here in Great Expectations with a character. There's a hint that Miss Havisham may be sort of somehow taking over, or the idea of Miss Havisham or what she represents takes over females that live in that house, and to destroy that you have to pull the curtains down. So it's got that association with Dracula. We've also got Martita Hunt and Freda Jackson in very prominent roles, who came back 15 years later to appear in Hammer's Brides of Dracula, and I think audiences going in to see Brides of Dracula may well have remembered them both from Great Expectations. And I think certainly older members of the audience at Brides of Dracula would have made that connection and would have said, oh yeah, it's the women from Great Expectations. And I think that would have filtered through to their appreciation of what Hammer were doing with their vampire movies. Also in terms of gothic, I think Lean, and certainly his production designers, were massively, massively influenced by the German expressionist cinema of the 20s. You can see there are sets in both movies, particularly in Oliver Twist, but certainly in Great Expectations as well. There are sets that looked very, very similar to the sort of stuff you'd see in early Robert Wiener or Fritz Lang movies. Wiener's Cabinet of Dr. Caligari being the sort of key film of that expressionist period, with its painted and angular sets, very, very famous. If you watch these two David Lean movies, you can see that influence here, you know. And
I mean, the set designs on both of these movies is astonishing, really. I mean, yeah, evoking that Gothic tradition, I guess, yeah, on film, and also, like you say, paying homage, I guess. It wasn't called homage then, but it was like nicking what they were doing in the German Expressionism. Yeah.
But then in turn had its own influence, because I think Hammer Films were certainly watching David Lean. As I said, Billy Wilder, when he made Sunset Boulevard, was copying this movie,
yeah,
you know, as much as he possibly could, in so many ways, in set design, in terms of characters, in terms of character relationships. I think if you watch Great Expectations alongside Sunset Boulevard, which is a sort of contemporary set Hollywood movie, but with a very, very Gothic sensibility and a real Miss Havisham character at the centre of it, you know, I think they make a great double bill.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And of course, I mean, this film starts with a great horror movie type scene, you know, the emergence of Magwitch in the graveyard. I mean, the opening of the film, you've got this sort of Edvard Munch sort of sky, which you also see in Oliver Twist as well. Howling winds, there's a creaking gibbet, isn't there? A sort of gallows, the creepy churchyard. There's even a gnarled tree that I always seem to spot a face within the bark of it. You know, it's like this, almost like there's this monstrous gnarled face sticking out of it. And then even when Magwitch enters, not just is it a surprise, not just is it a jump scare, but A, it's a jump scare, B, he's this great hulking bloke, C, he's clanking chains like Marley's ghost. Mm. And you're thinking, what the hell's this? You know, I think even readers of, even people who knew the novel well or the part work well, would have been astonished by Lean's representation of that character.
I mean, it is an interesting one, because, like, whenever we approach things like this from a modern age and reading, watching films, it's not always a given that people would have read the book for new films, because, you know. But back then, this book was like 70 years old by that point. Most people going to watch this film would have read the book, you know. It would have been mass produced. It was a huge smash hit on release. It was like continually being printed. So it was in that position where, in some ways, it was about hitting the beats, but they hit the beats so beautifully that it's almost like recreating those original Cruikshank drawings from the magazines, you know, and the original stories.
Which again plays into Oliver Twist.
Like, yeah, very much so, yeah.
About, you know, there was a very, very sort of purposeful attempt to copy Cruikshank in that movie in particular.
Yeah.
But that's right there in Great Expectations too, in the visual look of that. And I mean,
it's funny, you see some of that in Marvel movies and DC movies now, where you have particular sequences in those movies that are designed to represent what was happening in the comic books.
Yeah, to look like Jack Kirby or something.
Yeah, like Jack Kirby, or even just look like the cover to that one comic book that everyone knows. And it's like, so they still do that kind of like evocative filmmaking and design.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of David Lean's influence, I think he obviously looked at the Cruikshank drawings, and looked at German Expressionism, and looked at the Universal horror movies that had been inspired by that. You can see a lot of Frankenstein in this movie. But also, I think an influence that's been less talked about is British cinema of the 1940s itself, because by the time that Great Expectations was made, we'd already got Gainsborough Pictures underway, making their series of films largely aimed at a female audience, with people like James Mason as sort of villainous characters, often with Margaret Lockwood in them, you know. And you've got stuff like The Wicked Lady, The Man in Grey, that sort of movie. They Were Sisters, Fanny by Gaslight, A Place of One's Own, things like that. And then Mason going on to do stuff like The Seventh Veil, you know. And I think a lot of that is being made just before or just after these Lean films. And I think they all sort of play into each other. You know, again, it's this gothic look without them necessarily being gothic horror movies in the way that America was making with Frankenstein and Dracula. I think the British gothic sensibility was picked more at that sort of wicked squire sort of level, you know, females under threat sort of thing, the whole gaslighting thing as well. Gaslight was a big theme in British films at that time.
I think it was gothic romance. I think it's that kind of She Wuthering Heights. It's those kind of ones where it's not horror, as particularly in the Americans obviously took gothic meaning, and gothic has those horror overtones now. But I think at the time, if you said gothic to someone in the street, they wouldn't necessarily immediately think horror. They'll think the Moors and Cathy and those sweeping vistas, you know.
And interestingly, even British horror films of the 1940s tended to still play on that same template. You know, they offer Dead of Night aside, which is the sort of big one. I think if you look at the smaller British horror movies of the 1940s, things like Candles at Nine, Three Weird Sisters, House of Darkness, even Queen of Spades, the Torrell Dickinson movie, they're based much more in reality. They're much more on that sort of gothic romance sort of template, you know. And again, a lot of them took their tip from Great Expectations rather than from Dead of Night. You know, they sort of eschew the supernatural and they go for that David Lean sort of look.
Well, the David Lean, obviously they are beautifully staged, these films, but they really come to life with the outdoor stuff. I think whether they're staged outdoor or whether it's actually outdoor, it's almost regardless. He definitely likes a sweeping vista. Foreshadowing his future.
I love in this film we've talked about the set design already, but you've hit on it there, Adam. I think he stages scenes out of doors, but they're often filmed on a set. You know, his set designers are masterly at doing these sort of interior exteriors, you know, and I think they really give the film a sort of unique look. And again, it harks back to that German expressionism. It's what happens in Caligari, you know, the outdoor sets, the street scenes are all filmed in the studio. You know, they're all filmed against painted flats and painted backdrops.
Yeah, it does create a very specific, unique look that kind of goes away once on location filming becomes a big thing in cinema. That kind of look goes away in many respects, which is a shame because it has got its uniqueness. What did you think of the looks of these films, Becky?
For Great Expectations, I agree with the gothic feel, and particularly of Miss Havisham's house. And they really reflect how you imagine when you read about Miss Havisham and the idea of the cobwebs and the, you know, everything shut up, and you really get that feel when you look at it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like we can tell we're dealing with different class structures when a woman can just lock herself away for years and not have to worry about it. You know, it's like we're not dealing with working class people here now. Get out and work, woman. You know, there's none of that. It's like, oh no, she can afford to just while away her years playing the Machiavellian games with her charges.
Yeah, what do we think about Miss Havisham as a character and the way she's represented in this film? Because I've already referred to her as a sort of vampiric character, but I think there is a very nice and kindly side to her character as well. So you do get that, you know, the two sides of the coin there, I think.
Yeah, I don't think she's the out-and-out villain that she could have been portrayed as. But I think, I don't know, it's kind of a tricky one, because as we discussed earlier, as Becky was saying, because she just goes out of the film for such a long period, you kind of forget that she's part of this in many ways.
Yeah, it's a bit like that thing in Hound of the Baskervilles where Sherlock Holmes disappears for an hour, you know, and you're thinking, well, I paid to see a Sherlock Holmes film here, you know, what's going on? You know? And if you've turned on BBC Two in the afternoon on Boxing Day to watch this, to see Miss Havisham, you know, and you might find yourself thinking, well, you know, there's not as much of her as I remembered, you know. And I think that's largely down to Martita Hunt as the character making such an impact. Mm. I think you if you've not seen Great Expectations for a while, your memory of it is that she dominates the film. And I think in terms of screen time, she doesn't, but I think in terms of influence, she's all over it.
Yeah, yeah. I think the character is the same in the books as well. Yeah, you know, I think the character dominates your thought. That's the character that leaps off the page. Yeah.
And how difficult must that have been to sort of translate to film then? This to have this lingering idea of this character even when she's not on screen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's entirely successful, but I don't think it's necessarily the film's fault. I think it's probably, as we've discussed, it feels that source material is not really designed to be adapted for a film in the way it's done.
No. And again, Hammer did it with Dracula again. Mm. Christopher Lee's hardly on screen. He gets a few minutes of screen time, but when you think about Dracula, you think, oh, yeah, Christopher Lee dominates that film. And it's all about that presence. And if you can get an actor and a character sort of married in that way, meshed together in that way, I think that's an achievement, you know, because film's all about image. It's all about pointing a camera at something and filming it and then presenting that to an audience. And if you can manage to not do that and still make an impact, that's really great filmmaking, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And again, another thing that struck me was just how young Alec Guinness looks in this movie. It's like, you know, in my head, he's always older, either actually older, you know, as in like in the Star Wars movies, or playing older with makeup, as in like the Lady Killers and things like that, where he's aged up, or indeed Oliver Twist. So seeing him as a young man in this was just really strange for me.
Yeah, and I was saying earlier to Adam about Jean Simmons as Estella. For some reason, I remember her being the older Estella, and it's funny to see her so young and knowing how she looks when she's older. I always think of her when she's older. So yeah, the same as with Alec Guinness. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we've talked about Great Expectations, arguably the greatest Dickens adaptation, critically. Let's move on to Oliver Twist, which isn't without its problems, I think. Even today, definitely, but even back then, it had its problems. And Oliver Twist is Dickens' second novel, and it's also like it's the eighth adaptation, this. So it's been through the mill, this film, and it's like it's only the second sound one, but it was like done time and time again in the first 40, 50 years of cinema. What does David Lean think he can bring to the source material in 1948 that hadn't been brought to the material before?
I think he... It's almost a sequel to Great Expectations, in a sense, or a companion piece to it, certainly. He's doing the same thing. He's bringing that gothic sensibility to it again. And I think you can judge that from the opening sequence. I'd say Great Expectations' opening sequence is the best in any British movie. And the opening sequence of Oliver Twist is in the top five, I think. It's brilliant. You know, you've got Peeling Thunder, you've got shadows dominating the screen, very much in the Great Expectations world. And rain lashing down, the sort of swinging lanterns, and there's this young woman sort of racing, battling her way through it all. And even when she finds a haven, it's the parish workhouse, you know. So she's sort of trapped immediately. Mm. It's like, oh, you thought you were finding a place of safety. You're not, you know. And then we find out why she's sort of making her way there and what her story is. And it's immediately, yeah, we're in this gloomy sort of world all over again. you thought Great Expectations was depressing. You know, we're back again with more of the same guys, you know. And so I think Lean's mind is very much set on making this sort of companion piece to the earlier film.
And again, it is a fairly sort of like, whilst there have been quite a lot of silent adaptations of it, it's only the second sound one. And again, the first one with any kind of budget and cast. So as a prestige picture it goes, it's one of the first, you know, this and Great Expectations. This is the first Oliver Twist that would have played in multiple cinemas across the country and across the world. And it does nail the beats. It's fairly faithful adaptation.
Yeah, I think, again, when people think of Oliver Twist, they're not thinking so much of the Dickens novel as they're thinking about this film. And I think this has very much set the template for the subsequent remake.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oliver the Musical takes a lot from this.
Yeah.
Rather than necessarily the source material.
A lot of reviews pointed that out.
Right, okay. And then definitely, and I think the Oliver Musical is the one that people think of now, arguably.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think there's many people going back to the original Oliver Twist for many different reasons. Potentially because the character of Fagin is such an important part in this book.
I think the way that Fagin and the way that Oliver Twist are presented in Lean's film have become sort of templates. Although Fagin, the look of Fagin here is, again, as we've already said, based very heavily on the Crookshank illustration.
Well, that's what I was about to say. I think where he gets it wrong is with Fagin. Mm. And Fagin's such a key part of Oliver Twist that I think it's a failing of the movie when you get that character wrong. And I think Oliver the Musical, even though it took changes to the novel and the source material, I think we get a more, I want to say, true representation of what Fagin is, but I think at least a more audience-friendly version of what Fagin is. And I think that's what audiences want, and I think that's what audiences have become to expect from Dickens now, and the Fagin character.
Well, let's address this, because we've got Alec Guinness again, and he's now in a bigger role than he was even in Great Expectations, and a more central role playing Fagin.
So as I've just said, it was such a strange thing seeing him so young.
Yeah.
Just a year before.
Yeah.
They slap a load of makeup on him to make him look older.
Yeah.
To play Fagin.
He, you know, whatever you think of the character and the portrayal, it's a great performance. It's a magnetic performance, you know. But, you know, let's address the controversies of it.
Well, the controversies, obviously, nowadays, you would never, ever, ever get that made. With the obvious Jewish stereotypical look to the character that they did through makeup design, you would not get away with that now. You didn't get away with it then. Yeah, I'm happy to say.
I mean, this is 1948, which is quite an important year for the Jewish people.
It is kind of shocking that they actually did it. To be perfectly honest with you, we're in post-war. We've just had a world war unlike anything has been seen in the history of the world. The Jewish people have been persecuted, incarcerated and murdered in their millions. And then 4 years later, David Lean makes this film. And I don't care what his arguments are. They're flimsy arguments. At that point, they just are. There's no way you don't know.
And I don't think that's necessarily even a 21st century perspective. I think it was probably seen like that at the time.
It absolutely was.
As I say, you know, you've had the sort of horrors of World War II, and then the setting up of you know, states in the Middle East and so on. It's the most important time of the 20th century for the Jewish population, mm-hmm. the Jewish community, you know, and in the middle of it, here's this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they got away with it. I really don't. The arguments that they made about depicting Fagin like they did in the Crookshank drawings was that he was depicted like that in the Crookshank drawings, which is in itself a flimsy argument. And then they were saying, well, we took away some of the makeup, and Alec Guinness didn't work. Alec Guinness looked weird, so we put the makeup back on. It's like, well, if Alec Guinness looks weird without the makeup on, cast a different actor. You know, it's like, it's all within your power to do that, and he didn't do that. And all you can do is take that as a sign that he wanted to depict the stereotype of a miserly Jewish pickpocket on screen in 1948, and I don't know how that can be spun to be in any way acceptable.
Yeah, let's compare Guinness to Ron Moody playing the part in the 1968 film. Is Moody more acceptable, do you think, or are you going to make the same argument about him?
I think the performance is fine. I think it's more. I mean, for a start, Ron Moody is Jewish.
Yeah.
So he was the first Jewish actor to play the role. One of David Lean's arguments that it never said, it never explicitly states in the screenplay that Fagin is Jewish, which. It just feels like the most ridiculous argument.
Yeah. What are you saying? This character, the way he's depicted in Oliver Twist 1948, isn't Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, he was leaning heavily on negative stereotypes.
That's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but I think with the Ron Moody one, they humanise the character more, which is what I was saying about making that character more audience friendly and more in line of what audiences wanted from that.
And I think the very fact that you've turned Oliver Twist into a musical does that with the whole story.
Sure.
Anyway, you know, it sort of pairs and tones down the whole thing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because what we've got here basically is a story about what you were talking about earlier. It's about grimy, grim, underclass London. You know, it's about the absolute have-nots and people who are having to beg and steal and so on just to survive and live. And you turn that into a big West End musical, you know, and it's going to be played, you know, we all know and can sing along with the sort of jolly songs from that, you know, and it's bringing it up quite a few notches, you know. It's set in the gutter, but it is reaching for the stars, you know. And Lean's film and the original book are certainly not doing that.
Well, I think the original book's an interesting one because during the writing of the book, Dickens' attitudes towards Jewish people was changing. So as he was writing the book through the serialisation, it starts off and it's very heavy on the negative Jewish stereotypes. But as the book goes along and the months pass, as he's knowing more Jewish people and he's learning and growing as a person, just from the course of the... Towards the end, the last 10 or 5, 5 or 10 chapters and serialised bits, there's hardly any references to those negative Jewish stereotypes for the Fagin character. So even Dickens, as he was writing it, was changing and growing and understanding that the negative impact that depiction was having. And then Lean just goes back to the original drawing, which is...
I suppose one indication of that is the Bill Sykes character, who if you think Fagin's bad, you know, he's not the villain of the piece. You know, there's this other guy who's the real monstrous villain, you know. And at least Fagin's sort of quite friendly and he's almost got a love of sort for his charges, you know, and he's sort of training them to steal and pick pockets and so on. Sykes is just a monster. He obviously hates them and seems to sort of despise everything, you know, and he's just this horrible sort of brute of a man, which that in its own way sort of tones down the Fagin character a little, but you know, that doesn't make the portrayal of Fagin any more acceptable, you know.
Yeah.
Becky, you were talking about this sort of at the start of the podcast today, so that there were issues with this character. So let's hear your sort of take on it.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the main reason why I disliked it. I didn't realise the year it was made. I had to check which year it was. And I was surprised that the portrayal and it was just so incorrect. And I just couldn't, it was weird when I started watching the film because I just couldn't, I just know the Carol Reeve version so well, you know, it's always on the TV and I grew up with it, that I can't sort of imagine anybody else playing the characters than in that film. So I think a little bit to that as well made me just dislike the film. But yeah, and definitely it's one of Dickens' darkest novels. And I think the Bill Sykes character, I've always got the impression he's the real villain of it all. Obviously, you've got domestic violence and abuse, and you know, I think that everybody was a victim in that apart from Bill Sykes, really.
It is interesting about the music. Yeah. I think because it is unrelentingly grim. You know, just, yeah. That poor kid goes from one horrible situation to another, yeah. One after the other. You just can't get a break until the very end when he gets a break. But it's just like, yeah, watching it without the music and without the musical moments, it's like, oh God, this is horrible.
Yeah, it's almost like you could have a sort of cut of the Carol Reed film that took all the songs out. And it would be a completely different experience, you know. If you focus, as Lean does, on the degradation and on not just the degradation of the world that these characters live in, but of their minds and of their psyches as well, you know. And I think he manages to sort of convey that successfully in a way that the musical sort of dissipates simply by the fact that it is a musical, you know. Yeah, I think he really gets that right, and it'd be interesting to see a version of the Carol Reed film with all the songs taken out. You know,
I mean, the misery version.
Yeah, we covered Robert Altman on a recent podcast, and I love Altman's film Popeye, and I really like the songs in Popeye, which are often criticised for being very sort of downbeat and dull and very depressing, and I think that's the point in Popeye. I think that's these characters are downtrodden, and I almost want an Oliver musical to be like that. Popeye gives me what I would like an Oliver musical to be, but you're not going to sell any tickets to me.
I was about to say, one was a massive smash hit version that's loved throughout the world. The other one bombed and disappeared without a trace.
If you ain't got, you've got to pick a pocket or two, or consider yourself. You ain't going to sell ticket one, are you?
No, not at all. Yeah, I must admit, I found it a little bit too miserable for me, watching it, and then obviously the
I think David Lean would take that as a compliment.
Possibly.
Think that's the film he set out to make.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, for me, I didn't enjoy it as much as Great Expectations, and I think some of that was the depiction of Fagin, where it was just so caricature and so over the top in those negative stereotypes. It kind of threw me out of the movie a lot.
It does dominate the film in the way that Miss Havisham dominates Great Expectations, but not in as anywhere near as positive a way. I think.
And I think this movie is not quite as well wasn't quite as well respected as Great Expectations upon release. Expectations got an Oscar nominations and things like that. Oliver Twist didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It had a very tricky...
Oliver Twist's only, like, 75th in the BFI Top 100 or something.
46.
You know, rather than 5th.
It's 46, yeah. But yeah. I reckon that if you did that now, I'd be surprised if it was in there.
Yeah, it'd be a film, I think, that would, with modern sensibilities. And as I say, that's not a change, I don't think. I think the film at the time was seen as controversial.
Well, just looking some of the facts.
With modern sensibilities, you do a poll like that now, and that's gonna drop off the radar.
And I think just trying to put that to one side and watch the film is really hard. Yeah. I think maybe
which is a shame, because it's a great, great film.
Yeah, I think it looks beautiful. I mean, but it had a very tricky road. People didn't see it. It was released in 1949. It got a release in Germany and was protested against. It was banned in Israel. Ironically, it was banned in Egypt for showing unduly sympathetic Jewish characters.
Really?
The exact opposite of the reason why it was banned in Israel.
Yeah,
so
I can sort of see that, because I think the way Alec Guinness plays Fagin is, you know, despite the sort of stereotypes and so on, I think he's, as I said earlier, he's very kindly to these kids who've been put in his charge. And you know, whatever other sort of things emerge from this portrayal, I think I can see that Egyptian point of view there.
Yeah.
Why is he being friendly to these kids? Why is he helping them? He's almost like a father to them. You know? Yeah. We're not showing that.
Yeah. And I guess most importantly, where it counts in America, it didn't get a release until 1951. Mm. And even then, it was cut by 12 minutes.
Yeah, and I can imagine which 12 minutes as
and
well.
And I think a lot of that, I mean, Americans didn't get to see the full version until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So it's had, and by that point, the definitive Oliver Twist had been released with Ron Moody playing Fagin. So
yeah, so it's like, what's this dull black and white version of Oliver? We've got the one, the nice sing along one, you know. Yeah,
it's had a tricky road.
Yeah, again, to talk about real positives in the film, and I think the positives of it are that it is a companion piece to Great Expectations, and again, that's reflected in the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari look to it. I think both films depict London in a very interesting way, and Great Expectations is almost like a little trial run for Oliver Twist, in that you get a handful of scenes set in London, again, largely on interior sets, so you've got that sort of expressionist sort of look to it. And then Lean does the entire movie like that with Oliver Twist. And he does a very, very interesting thing in terms of this business of interior exteriors. When in the scenes of the pickpockets going out into London, going into affluent areas to steal from sort of the well-to-do and business people and so on, seem to be shot on genuine exteriors and genuine locations. And then the London set scenes that are set in their world, their sort of subterranean world, are shot on expressionist type sets. So you get this visual difference there. You know, the sun is out, it's bright, there's clean air, there's gents in top hats and so on, there's coaches and horses driving past. This is the very affluent, very real world, you know, and this is where the kids emerge from like rats to sort of steal, and then they scurry back into Caligari land, you know. I think that's tremendously successful as a visual.
Yeah, no, I agree. It definitely evokes those two worlds that are, and also evokes that class structure as well, which is a big part of the social aspect of social commentary of Dickens' books. He's obviously creating those two worlds and showing the stark differences between.
Again, there's a brilliant monkey and. Sort of skyline and even a scream-like road in the scene where Oliver decides to run away from the funeral parlour where he's living and make his way to London, and the road that he runs up is basically the one out of the scream.
Yeah.
I personally hated the film. I'd be happy not to watch it again.
Did you not find that the way it was filmed interesting or anything like that, Becky? Or was it just... Too hard to get on board.
Yeah, it was just too hard to get on board. I don't know if it's because Carol Reed versions, you know, had such a. It's how I see Oliver.
There was a lot of similarities in that respect, particularly in costume.
Yeah.
When you look
at
the costume, the way that the Artful Dodger is, they basically just put it in colour. For the Carol Reed version, you know, there's this put a colour filter on that, and it would have been exactly the same. You know, there was and Oliver, the kid Oliver, looks so much like the kid Oliver.
Oh, he does, which is what I was saying earlier. That I think when people think of Oliver Twist now, I think the reason Mark Lester and subsequent actors have been cast in that part is that they look like John Howard Davis in this film. Yeah. I think David Lean sort of... I mean, I can't recall whether Oliver's depicted. I'm sure he must be in the novel. Were there illustrations of him, and what did he look like in those?
I'm sure there will have been illustrations. Yeah, it'd be hard not to have a book called Oliver Twist and not have Oliver.
Because obviously they copied the drawings of Fagin.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't recall the precise look of Oliver in the 19th century illustrations, but I think the casting of John Howard Davis here is something that every other filmmaker since has sort of taken on board. And also, I think you're seeing here with characterisations like Anthony Newley playing the Artful Dodger, and one or two of the other characters as well. I think there are even characters earlier in the film, even before Oliver gets involved with the urchins and Fagin and Bill Sykes. I think earlier on in the film, you've got Diana Dawes appears, for instance, and you've got other characters in the sort of the downstairs part of the sort of upstairs downstairs. Dwelling that Oliver finds himself in, the sort of servants' quarters, and then with Newley as Fagin as well. What you're seeing there is almost the birth of a new type of British acting, which I think then extends through to the 80s, and people like Gary Oldman and Tim Roth coming through, and Phil Daniels and Phil Davis and people like that. I think that breed of British actor is born in this film, you know. The fact, oh right, we've got these young kids sort of, you know, 17, 18 playing these urchin type characters, and they're basically talking in their own voices, they're doing sort of Cockney accents because they are Cockneys, you know. And I can imagine a young Tim Roth or somebody watching this film and taking that from this and thinking, oh yeah, I can do that, you know.
Mm. I think Lean does something interesting with the story in that he brings Oliver into the film a bit more, because in the book he kind of like disappears at the end when they're doing the whole Bill Sykes, Nancy Fagin story.
Yeah, which is what I was saying earlier about purists.
Yeah.
I think this film got, aside from all the other flack that it's got here and there, you know, I think Charles Dickens purists like the depiction of Fagin in the film because it's real and authentic, you know, in terms of the illustration. What they don't like is the ending, because it changes the ending of the
well, it
the
does, book, but in the book, your central character goes missing for the finale of the book.
I think this is a better ending.
I completely agree, and obviously, yeah. Oliver, the musical, did as well, because they did the same thing. They brought him back into the centre of the action towards the end of the film. Mm. And I think that works really well. And that's an interesting. If you're going to tinker with stuff when you're adapting it, that's a really positive. To the point where now people will see that story as that's how it happened. He's a bit of a wet fish, though, isn't he, Oliver? He's a bit like, for God's sake, kid, you know.
Doesn't the character need to be like
possibly,
that?
Possibly, but it's a fine line like between being the wide-eyed innocent and being
insipid.
And I think they just about get it right in this one and in the Matt Lester playing you in Oliver, but it's a knife edge, isn't it?
I want to mention, in terms of both films, we talked about influences and not to do Lean Down, because I think both of these films have been massively influential in the ways that we've discussed, but they've also taken their influences. And one we've not mentioned so far, which I think is really, really prominent in both, is Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
I think the look of Orson Welles' Citizen Kane and the developments that brought to cinema and the experimentation that brought to cinema. David Lean had got his notebook out, I think, watching that movie, and I think it shows here.
Yeah, you can see some of a lot in the transitions between scenes. They're very much like, you know, voiceovers or on-screen dialogue. I think there's a lot of interesting ways of transitioning between scenes, which I think you feel he took from things like Citizen Kane.
Yeah, but I think to Lean's credit, one thing he takes from Kane is I think he does steal things directly from Citizen Kane, but the other thing he took from Citizen Kane was inspiration. Mm-hmm. The chance. I think he watched that film and thought, hey, you know, you can go crazy with cinema now. You can experiment. You can go wild.
Mm.
There's a shot towards the end of Great Expectations, which I wanted to mention earlier on, where after John Mills has spoken to the dying Magwitch and found out his relationship to him and so on, in a complete daze, and he heads back to the rooms that he shares with the Alec Guinness character, Pocket, isn't it? There's this sort of whirring and buzzing sound on the soundtrack, and then something like a fan appears in superimposed over the shot, and you just get this incredible sort of jerky point of view shot as he sort of heads back into his digs. And you could put that in an experimental movie today. You could take that single shot and present it as part of a sort of experimental film program in 2021, and it would not be out of place. You know, it's an overused word in modern cinema analysis and criticism, but it's Lynchian.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously creating that sort of like mindset as a film technique.
Yeah, you know? And it's so striking and surprising to see in what is otherwise a fairly conventional 1940s film. You know, suddenly there's this 30 seconds of wild experimentation, and again, you know, that's in there because Citizen Kane exists.
So, do you think does Lean in the rest of his career, does he build on that? Because I mean, I've seen the epics. And with all due respect, I don't really want to see them again.
I think he's done by this point. I think he's done with Dickens. He's sort of done the two novels.
I meant the experimentation in film techniques.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think the two go together. I think he sees these as his chance to experiment and his chance to sort of build on what Orson Welles has given to cinema. I think his other films, he's off onto another area by then, and he's got his eye on, already I think by the 50s, he's got his eye on sort of doing the epics.
Yeah.
And again, we covered Summertime on a recent podcast, which is experimental in its own way, I think, but very, very different to these films.
Yeah, no, I think the outdoor shooting started to come into him.
And colour, of course, vitally, yeah. I think. Which he'd already used on Blythe Spirit by this time, but I think colour became much more part of his sort of template. And, I think these films were very, very important to him in terms of wanting to try things out to advance cinema and advance his own sort of style of cinema.
Cool.
I don't think he ever intended to build on that. I get the impression it was just, let's do this now.
Yeah.
And then I can do something else and then something else. And then in time, I can do what I really want to do, which is make films that are 4.5 hours long, you know.
That Adam will watch once and never again. So that's David Lean's brace of Dickens adaptations. Thank you for joining us, Becky and Daryl. We'll see you again next time. Take care.